what happened to you is what didn't happen for you. What attention, nurturing touch, reassurance, basically what love didn't you get? I realized that neglect is as toxic as trauma. Dr. Perry.
When you say neglect, what do you mean? Isn't neglect traumatic?
Well, I do think that in most cases, neglect and trauma co-occur, but they cause very different biological experiences and can have very different effects on the brain and the developing child. Some people have used the term complex trauma to try to capture developmental neglect and maltreatment, but I believe that lumps too many things into one box.
So help me understand neglect.
Okay. Let's think about the developing child. In order for the genetic potential of that child to be expressed, a variety of necessary experience is required. If these experiences are absent, or if their timing, pattern, or nature is abnormal, key capabilities do not develop. Neglect is most destructive early in life when the brain is rapidly growing. Early neglect interferes with the child's getting the necessary stimulation required for normal development. You've probably heard of the Romanian orphans. It is likely that more than 500,000 children spent part of their early lives in state-run orphanages during Ceausescu's regime in Romania. In 1989, when communism ended in the country, the public and the press saw the horrible conditions these children had been subjected to. There were often 40 to 60 babies or toddlers in a single large room, each in their own crib all day long, with only one or two caregivers rotating among them over the course of a 12-hour shift. The children suffered deprivation, malnutrition, abuse, and more. Even after being removed from the institutions, they grew up with a range of deficits. Some had low IQs, others couldn't walk. Most had major problems forming and maintaining relationships. I worked with many children removed from these orphanages. In general, the longer the child was there, the longer the deprivation, the more serious the problems. Ironically, in some overcrowded institutions, children who had to share cribs ultimately did better. The Romanian orphans are now adults. For most of them, problems persist. As a group, they are much more likely to be unemployed, have mental and physical health problems, and have difficulties with relationships. Similar isolated cases have happened in the United States, and our clinical group has worked with many children and youth who've emerged from extremely neglectful backgrounds. These children grow up under-socialized. They have no toilet training, cannot use utensils, they have minimal language skills. In the most extreme cases, they appear wild. The term used is feral. You actually highlighted the story of one of these children, Danny, the girl in the window, on the Oprah Winfrey Show. She was locked up and profoundly neglected for the first 6 years of her life, with tragic results. Fortunately, she was removed and adopted.
When she got into a loving home, she started to get better, but she continued to struggle with communication and social interactions.
Yes, and she struggles to this day. So many important things happen in the developing brain of a child in the first 6 years of life. And if key neural networks do not get the right experiences at the right times, some essential capabilities will not develop normally. We still have so much to learn about this, and we know that other developmental factors, such as intrauterine insults or birth trauma, may be involved in extreme cases like Danny's. But as seen with the Romanian orphans, the longer you spend in a deprived developmental environment, the harder it will be to recover.
But these examples, like Danny, are so uncommon. 6 years is such a long time. What happens if it's only 1 year? What if it's only when one specific babysitter comes over? What if you ground a teenager and they basically have to stay in their room for a month? Is that neglect?
No. Grounding a teenager is not neglect because key systems in the brain have already developed. I'm not advocating that you send a 15-year-old to their room for a month, but it isn't the same as a month of deprivation in early childhood. But the issues you raise are important ones. And just as with trauma, several essential questions can help us assess whether a situation is neglectful, and if so, how great its impact will be. When during development did the neglect take place? What was the pattern? How severe or depriving was the neglect? How long did it last? And since absolute total neglect is rare, what buffering factors were present when the neglect occurred? The most common form of neglect is fragmented, patternless caregiving. Some days when the infant cries, adults come to feed and nurture them. Other days, no one comes. Still other days, someone comes and yells at, shakes, or hurts them. This confusing, chaotic world is very dysregulating. The infant gets insufficient structure to send a clear, organized set of signals to the developing systems in the brain. The infant's world is unpredictable, and the result is a chaotic neglect. Key systems develop in a fragmented, disorganized way, leading to functional problems. Another kind of neglect, splinter neglect, occurs when many aspects of development are normal and some key systems receive appropriately timed experiences, but one or more does not, leading to the absence of a critical aspect of healthy development. Let me give you an example. I once worked with 5 siblings, ages 11, 8, 6, 4, and 2. They were all delightful. Their mother was raising them on her own. She had 2 doctoral degrees and loved her children very much. The problem was that she had a fixed delusion and a profound fear that her children would be harmed if they left her sight. So she started to keep the children in the same room with her, all the children, all day, all night. Over time, she started to homeschool, and she insisted that the children sit in car seats on the couches. She got to the point where she kept them in physical restraint in the car seats, didn't let them crawl or walk. She was warm to these children and very focused on their cognitive development. All the children were 2 or more academic grades advanced. They were verbal and socially interactive with one another, but even the oldest child could barely stand up. There had been a splinter deprivation of motor activity. The result was a family of children with grossly underdeveloped legs and neuromotor capability. This is an extreme example of splinter neglect, but there are many other examples where one important domain of development is relatively ignored or understimulated, including emotional development.
There are different ways to neglect a child. I've seen children grow up neglected because they were unseen in the household, emotional ghosts like James.
Exactly. I've worked with several emotionally neglected children of very wealthy parents who chose to outsource parenting, but did so in a way that was developmentally uninformed. They didn't understand the importance of relational consistency early in life, so their infant was cared for by different shifts of hired caregivers.
What do you mean by that? There's a lot of messaging in the world that tells us it doesn't matter who or how many people are caring for a child as long as that child is receiving love and attention. Is that wrong?
Well, that's a great question. In general, the more attentive and loving people in your life, the better. But if you remember our earlier discussions about the developing brain and the process of creating your worldview, you'll remember that early in life, the brain needs consistent, patterned experiences to develop some key systems. Let's look at language development to illustrate what I mean. Say you speak only English to an infant for 6 weeks and then say, "English is done, we're going to speak Chinese." For the next 5 months, the child hears only Chinese. But then, we're done with Chinese, now we're going to speak French. And then the language spoken to the child changes 10 more times before they turn 3. This poor child will not speak any language at all. Despite the fact that these are good languages and that all the languages activate the speech and language part of the brain, there were never sufficient repetitions with any one language to properly organize the child's full speech and language capability. Language disruptions would also take place if the child heard 15 different languages spoken each day. There would be insufficient time and insufficient repetitions with any one language for the infant's developing brain to make sense of any of the languages. language development would be delayed and possibly abnormal. It's the same thing with relationships. If you familiarize with one person for 6 weeks and then they disappear, and a new person starts caring for you, and then that person disappears, and so on, your infant brain hasn't had sufficient repetitions with any single person to create the architecture that allows you to develop healthy relational neurobiology. The key to having many healthy relationships in your life is having only a few safe, stable, and nurturing relationships in your first year. This lets you get adequate repetitions to build the foundation, the fundamental relational architecture that will allow you to continue to grow healthy relational connections. Again, think of language. Once you've learned one or two primary languages, you can go on to learn many others. But when an infant, toddler, or child grows up in a household where loving is outsourced, the result can be a form of splinter neglect, where key relational capabilities are undeveloped or stunted.
And I think as we become more and more dependent on technology in so many aspects of our lives, one big aspect is the care of our children. More and more I see parents outsourcing childcare to the phone or tablet, or the children are left to their own metaphorical devices while the parents are distracted by their literal devices. Once, I remember this so well, I was driving in Chicago. My car ended up behind a horse-drawn carriage, and the children were leaning out and looking around. The mother was on her phone, chitty-chitty-chatting away for the entire ride, and not once did she engage with the children or even look at them. And I kept thinking, when they're done, she'll post a picture saying, look at us, wasn't that great? We did the horse and carriage ride. I see this so often now, parents who are with their children, but not really with them.
Exactly. I think this is a huge problem in our distracted society. We're not very good at truly being present.
Even a baby can tell when you're there. They know if you're excited or happy. They can feel it. They know if they're safe or not. They want eye contact.
Absolutely. They want full engagement. They want you to be present. The inability to be really present has a toxic impact on healthy development. As we've talked about earlier, the infant's brain is trying to make sense of the world. And because we are social creatures, a crucial part of this is building a sense of belonging. I matter. I'm one of the clan. This comes from getting specific "you matter" signals from others, especially your family. And it requires giving the infant, toddler, or child your attention. Not partial attention. Fully engaged attention. I'm looking at you. I'm listening. I'm right here with you. All of us have had the experience of having a conversation with somebody and feeling dismissed when they disengage to look at their phone. And even though we're adults and we have developed brains and we understand how the world works, it still feels disrespectful. It hurts.
It feels like I wasn't important enough to hold your attention.
Exactly. I am not important enough. It's bad enough to get that message from someone when you're an adult. Just imagine if this is a constant message the baby gets when they're creating their worldview. I'm not important. The infant's capability to be empathic and nurturing, their capacity to love, depends upon the nature, quality, and number of loving interactions they experience early in life. A dismissive, disengaged interaction is not building the foundation for a loving person. On the contrary, it's building the foundation for an emotionally hungry, needy person who will long for belonging, but won't have the neurobiological capacity to really find what they need. Dismissive caregiving can lead to an unquenchable thirst for love. You cannot love if you have not been loved.
From a scientific perspective, what is happening when a mom or dad is on their cell phone while their child is attempting to have a shared experience with them?
Well, there's a famous experiment in developmental psychology created by a friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Ed Tronick, that can give us a clue. In brief, a parent is instructed to not give any expression when interacting with their baby. They're asked to be disengaged, passive, and cool toward the child. The infant immediately tries to engage the parent and within seconds of being unsuccessful, becomes significantly distressed.
They start crying.
Often they do. The experiment shows viscerally that within seconds of a child perceiving their parent to be disengaged or emotionally absent, they start to feel distress and attempt to re-engage the parent. But when these efforts fail, the infant disengages and emotionally withdraws. Imagine the impact on a developing child if that is a continuous experience. A cold, disengaged, partially attentive caregiver can have an immediate and potentially lifelong toxic effect on the developing child. This child may grow up feeling inadequate, unlovable. Even with many gifts and skills, they will feel they're not enough as an adult, and that can lead to a host of maladaptive behaviors, including unhealthy forms of attention-seeking, self-sabotaging, or even self-destructive behavior.
And when a young child depends on their parent or caregiver to regulate them, and that caregiver is dismissive, disengaged, or even absent when the infant needs comfort or food, this is creating that pattern of stress activation for the infant that is unpredictable and uncontrollable.
Exactly. And that creates a sensitized stress response. Let's talk about that. We know the human body, whether you're an infant or an adult, has several systems that help you deal with whatever challenge you're facing in the moment. The one most people are familiar with is the fight or flight response, which we've talked about.
So, thinking about these different states, calm, alert, alarm, fear, terror, walk me through what's happening here.
When we are stressed, there is a graded response, gradually activating the systems in the brain and body that will help us. When you're not under any stress, you can be calm. You can reflect on the past, the future. But as soon as you have any challenge, say a presentation at work, you enter a state of alert. You scan the crowd, study faces as you present, trying to gauge if your point is being made. Do they get this? Do they like my presentation? Are they bored? And later in the day, you get into a small fender bender, and for a moment you enter the alarm state. You're kind of frozen, not sure what to do. Should I call my insurance? Do I need to report this to the police? Should I get his information? You're temporarily in brain freeze when suddenly the other driver jumps out of his car and starts screaming and threatening you with a gun. Now you enter a state of full-blown fear. And this is where another major component of your stress response capabilities kicks in, dissociation. Your brain is continually monitoring the situation and constantly assessing options. Am I going to be able to run away from this? Am I going to be able to win this fight? Your brain says you can't win a fight with a guy who's got a gun, so you start to try avoiding additional conflict and apologize profusely. You have a sensation of watching this happen to you as if you're in a movie. You are so robotically compliant with his demands that you pay him on the spot. Your sense of time distorts. You are dissociating. Your body is preparing for potential injury. Your heart rate drops. Instead of all of your blood going to your muscles to help you fight or flee, you constrict peripheral blood flow. You can get pale or even faint. Your body is preparing you for injury by disconnecting you from the threat of the outside world and bringing you into your inner world. Your body releases endogenous opioids, endorphins, and enkephalin, and you literally have the sensation that you're watching something happen to you.
And that's what people describe as an out-of-body experience and very often don't fully remember what happens next.
Exactly. This dissociative response is used when there is inescapable, unavoidable distress and pain. Because you cannot physically flee and fighting is futile, you psychologically flee to your inner world. So going back to the infant with a disengaged parent, the infant's fight or flight response is to cry, but if no one comes, or they come and are angry, the helpless infant will dissociate to survive this inescapable, distressing situation. The same is true for children, youth, and adults faced with any inescapable, unavoidable pain and distress. They dissociate, and a whole set of neurophysiological changes helps you do that, including the release of your body's own opiates.
Is that why people say everything slowed down?
That's right. When you are in that dissociative state, your sense of time dissolves. experiences that are only seconds long can seem like minutes. Minutes can feel like you are trapped in a timeless moment. I have debriefed FBI agents after shootings, for example. An agent might take 8 minutes to describe an event that was actually 10 seconds long. And it's because in that moment, their brain is floating. They're out of their body watching something happen. Many of us can connect with that feeling if we have ever experienced grief, which can elicit a feeling of numbness. We sometimes robotically go through the motions of daily living or have moments where we feel as if we are in a movie.
I'm fascinated by what you're saying because I've often wondered, for example, about the people who were on the airplanes on 9/11. They knew there was a terrorist and that they only had moments to call their families. And in that moment of terror, there must have been some sense of dissociation because many were able to still function enough to call family or write a note or rush the cockpit.
And what you're pointing out is how adaptive it is to partially dissociate in many situations. If a soldier in combat simply went down the arousal continuum and got to the flee and then fight stages, he would jump up and get shot. In order to maintain access to parts of his cortex, to think and behave in the ways he was trained to keep him alive in combat, he needs to dissociate to a certain degree. It's critical to survival. Without dissociation, the more a person is threatened, the more fearful they become, and the more the cortex shuts down. Being able to partially dissociate, to disengage from parts of the external threatening world and focus on trained behaviors, is key to success in competitive sport or high-pressure performances in the arts. The terms flow and in the zone are used to describe some of these partial dissociative states.
In reality, everyone uses dissociation every day. That's what daydreaming is, right? And it can be a healthy coping mechanism.
Exactly. Mind wandering. Reflective thinking and creativity require that we stop in the middle of a moment, reflect, and spend time in our head. We reflect on the past and imagine the future, making dissociative disengagement a key part of daily life. And it's essential for relational interaction as well.
I was surprised when you told me that most people can only be completely focused on someone and what they're saying for about 15 seconds, and then the mind wanders. It focuses in and out on how what the other person is saying relates to something else in the listener's life and how that connects to something else, and back and forth.
And that's a very normal and adaptive capability. We should understand that dissociation is not a bad thing, though it can happen in bad circumstances. Dissociating itself is a good thing. For example, a child daydreaming in class can indicate creativity. Our current public education system is good at producing workers, but it can be a miserable place for creators, artists, and future leaders.
Very often we punish the child who's daydreaming.
Absolutely, we do. But in a developmentally informed, trauma-aware school, there's an understanding that downtime plays a crucial role for memory consolidation. Dissociative reflection is encouraged.
Ah, yes, I'm very much aware of this principle of dissociation because of my school in South Africa. The girls there are brilliant. You've met many of them, but they all come from challenged, traumatized backgrounds. And we had to train our teachers to understand that daydreaming or dissociation is actually good for them. It's an expected coping mechanism when you're raised in an environment where there's inescapable chaos and minimal support or other ways to keep yourself regulated. You need to be able to shut yourself down. You need to dissociate from that environment and its intensity in order to survive.
Exactly. Dissociation as a coping mechanism will happen more commonly when the individual feels that a threatening situation is inescapable. If you're a child and your family has a lot of conflict, you don't have many options. You can't say, "Hey, I'm moving out." Very young children can't fight or flee. They have to stay.
At what point does dissociation as a coping mechanism become dissociative disorder, where the child increasingly takes herself to her inner world?
Well, you kind of nailed it earlier when you talked about the infant with the disengaged parent. Remember that a pattern of stress that is unpredictable, uncontrollable, and prolonged will sensitize the stress response systems. And if dissociation is your preferred mode of stress adaptation for long periods of time when you're young, you end up with a sensitized dissociative response to any challenge. The dissociative response is overactive and overly reactive. Some of the young women at Owleg, for example, after growing up in chaos and threat as young girls, would dissociate in the face of any challenge, when faced with any discomfort whatsoever.
I think this part of our discussion is going to be helpful to a lot of people who wonder why they tend to check out. Why can't I stay in the game when things get challenging? It's because your brain has been trained to dissociate when things become uncomfortable or feel like a threat to you. Even if a math test isn't as big a threat as someone who wants to harm you, your dissociative response may be so overly reactive that your response to the math test is to shut down.
Exactly. But the response is not always a complete shutdown. As we've discussed before, the dissociative response to challenges and threats happens on a continuum. For individuals who tend to have a dissociative response to stress, the first stage in the continuum is avoidance. These people don't want conflict. They want to be invisible, avoid eye contact, don't volunteer, stay quiet in discussions. If they can't be invisible and somebody confronts them, what do you think? They shift to compliance, but it's a hollow compliance.
They answer what they think the other person wants to hear, but they're not engaged in the exchange.
Exactly. This is one of the most challenging parts of working with children who have had developmental trauma.
And it isn't just children. I've seen this behavior in adults. I remember a show we did years ago with Gary Zukav where a woman explained that after experiencing early sexual abuse, she would sabotage her adult relationships, whether they were happy or not, by removing herself emotionally. She dissociated, even though she said she cared deeply about her partner. She'd go through the motions of being in the relationship, compliance, but as you say, it was a hollow compliance. She wasn't really there. But after working with a therapist to create and maintain healthy relationships, she now actively practiced staying present. And Gary Zukav validated her feelings by acknowledging that for many people, there is, in his words, a terror of being alive. I'll never forget that phrase.
Interesting that he says that. One of the common behaviors seen with a sensitized dissociative response is cutting. And often someone who cuts will say, "It makes me feel alive to see my blood. It is soothing."
Can you please explain the psychology behind cutting? I think I am not alone in not really understanding how people can be addicted to it.
Yeah, cutting can be very confusing from the outside. We've talked about how your stress response systems can become overly reactive, how anyone experiencing inescapable and unavoidable trauma will dissociate, and how, if the pattern of this trauma is prolonged or extreme, the dissociative systems become sensitized, overactive, and overly reactive. Remember that dissociation releases opioids, enkephalins and endorphins, your own painkillers. If a person without a sensitized dissociative response cuts themselves, their body releases a little bit of these opioids so they can tolerate the cut. The amount released would be pretty small and proportional to the little cut. But when someone with a sensitized, overly reactive dissociative response cuts themselves, they release a lot of opioid. It's almost like taking a little hit of heroin or morphine.
Are you saying it actually feels good that the cut doesn't feel like a cut?
Exactly. The opioid burst from cutting can actually feel regulating, soothing. It is rewarding for some. It makes them feel good.
It doesn't hurt?
No. In fact, it can become their preferred method of self-regulation.
I never thought of it that way. So, in order to feel that sense of soothing, you have to be in a dysregulated state. And if you're in a regulated state, cutting would hurt, right?
Right. You have to have a sensitized dissociative response. This usually comes from a history of abuse that was painful, inescapable, and unavoidable. Essentially, chronic chaos and threat when you were an infant or a young child. Or, very often, sexual abuse.
What's happening to you is inescapable.
Yes. And then your dissociative neurobiology becomes sensitized, overly reactive. And you discover that a reliable way to self-soothe, to ease the pain, is to cut yourself.
This is fascinating. I've wondered about this for a very long time because I have girls who've come, as we've said before, from difficult, challenged backgrounds. And I created OLAG to give them opportunities, and the trajectory of their lives changed. And yet, we had a cutting problem at the school. And each time I was told about it, I wondered how anybody even knows to cut themselves. How do they learn to do that? Did they watch somebody else? What if the school didn't exist and these same girls were still in their villages or townships? Would they be cutting there? Are people in those villages also cutting?
That's a really interesting question. If we start with early trauma, little children who have this sensitized response sometimes discover that when they pick at a scab or scratch a mosquito bite, wow, that feels good. They begin to learn that self-mutilating can be regulating. But this makes up a fraction of the total group of people who end up cutting. It turns out that many people learn about it from their peers. You can sometimes even track the rates of cutting when a popular TV show talks about it. Some children will experiment with cutting and say, "No way, this hurts. I'm not doing that anymore." And others will say, "Wow, that's good." Just like drugs. A percentage of high school students will experiment with a drug, but only 18 to 20% will end up having trouble with recurrent use. And if you look at the people who go back and use again and again and again, very high percentages of them are the ones who have had developmental adversities. Among the children who don't go back, fewer have had developmental adversities.
Drugs are a different form of regulation for some people who've experienced trauma.
So true. There are different maladaptive forms of self-regulation, but all of them tie into the same basic neurobiology of the stress and reward systems. Some children rock and bang their heads against a wall, for example. It has the same effect, and other children will discover that pulling out their hair or their eyebrows gives a little bit of an opiate burst.
This is so important to understand. I did not realize how this is all tied together.
Children will find a way to soothe. Making yourself throw up can also cause that opioid burst. So there are eating disorders related to self-soothing and not to body image. It's a maladaptive form of soothing.
This is fascinating, but these behaviors are somewhat extreme. Are there more common coping behaviors?
Absolutely. And they can develop into personality characteristics that at first are not easy to recognize, but may affect how people either avoid or step right into a troublesome situation or interact with challenging people.
I mentioned earlier that for so much of my life, one of my major personality characteristics was being a people pleaser. It affected everything. It affected my weight, my health, my businesses, my relationships. When you're a victim of abuse and you're taught to be quiet about it, you end up always wanting to please people because you've learned that speaking up will result in punishment. You don't have a concept of how to say no.
Absolutely. People-pleasing is a classic coping mechanism that is part of the compliant behaviors seen with dissociation. But again, it's important to remember that dissociation and self-regulating behaviors that are dissociative are not all bad. The capacity to control your dissociative capabilities is very powerful. It allows people to be good at reflective cognition. It allows people to have intense focus on a specific task. Hypnosis, flow, being in the zone, all of these are examples of the trance state that dissociation allows. People who learn to control when and how they go into a trance state have a gift. I can guarantee you, Oprah, that you're really good at dissociating. It's one of your superpowers. Let's start with how you love reading.
Oh, yes, that's true. Books for me have always been a way to escape. They were my path to personal freedom. I actually learned to read at the age of 3. And once I did, I quickly learned that there was a whole world beyond my grandmother's farm in Mississippi.
Right. And you are clearly reflective. And you can go to places in your head and imagine things in the future in ways that a lot of people have a hard time doing. That's dissociation. It's healthy, healing, and productive. This is why people need to be careful about labeling dissociation as a pathology, as a strictly negative behavior. It can be an incredible strength. But for you, at times, it sounds as if your dissociative adaptations led to you being compliant. You were trying to give people what they wanted.
Yes, people-pleasing.
Absolutely. That was your default. Stay under the radar, do what's asked of you, don't give anyone reason to be angry, just give people what they want.
100%. Just give people what they want.
But over time, you've changed. You've dosed yourself away from that overly compliant behavior. You often use the term intention, and when you say it, I think controllable. Your life is busy, full of challenges and demands, yet you take that set of stressors and you use boundaries and intention to make the pattern of your life's stress more predictable, controllable, and moderate. That is a healing and resilience-building pattern of stress activation.
I learned about the power of intention from Gary Zukav. It really, literally changed everything for me. It's the guiding force in my life. Gary taught me that an intention precedes every thought and every action, and that the outcome of your experiences is determined by your intention going in. Sounds complicated, maybe, but really, there's nothing I do that doesn't start with my asking myself, what is my intention in doing this? Once I got that, I started to make my decisions based on what I intended, not just on what someone else wanted me to do or what I thought would please them. I had a lot of bullies in my life, but the power of intention helped me create boundaries to do only what I wanted to do because it felt authentic to me. And with every decision, big or small, learning to say no has healed me, and intention has saved my life. But speaking of decisions and choices, I want to turn to a question that baffles so many of us. Why is it that people who are victims of trauma are so often drawn to abusive relationships?
Well, let me broaden the question, because it's so important in understanding not just abuse, but all behavior. The key point is that all of us tend to gravitate to the familiar. Even when the familiar is unhealthy or destructive, we are drawn to what we were raised with. As we've said before, when we're young and our brain is beginning to make sense of our experiences, it creates our working model of the world. The brain organizes around the tone and tension of our first experiences. So if, early on, you have safe, nurturing care, you think that people are inherently good. And, as we also talked about earlier, this worldview makes you project goodness onto the people you meet. And that projection of goodness elicits good things in return. But if as a child you've experienced chaos, threat, or trauma, your brain organizes according to a view that the world is not safe and people cannot be trusted. Think about James. He didn't feel safe when he was close to people. Intimacy made him feel threatened. Here's the confusing part. James felt most comfortable when the world was in line with his worldview. Being rejected or treated poorly validated this view. The most destabilizing thing for anyone is to have their core beliefs challenged. As psychologist Virginia Sater puts it, we feel better with the certainty of misery than the misery of uncertainty. Good or bad, we are attracted to things that are familiar.
So, if you come from an abusive background, you might be in a relationship with somebody who is abusive because it's familiar?
Yes. In fact, if you get into a relationship with somebody who's not treating you poorly, you may find yourself feeling increasingly uncomfortable. And then, unconsciously, your mind might seek a predictable response. You may try to provoke a bit of a response. Maybe I'll do X and it'll piss him off. If this elicits the behavior you're most familiar with, he gets angry and treats you poorly, it can actually be validating. The worldview has been confirmed. Even though the result is chaos and conflict, it's comforting in the sense that it's familiar.
I go through this with a lot of my girls at school. We hand select young women who are smart and show such promise, but so many were raised in an environment where they did not see or experience what real love looks like or what an expression of real love feels like. For women in their communities, at home, and within the family, abuse is systemic and it goes beyond physical abuse. People don't show up when they say they're going to show up. They don't follow through with what they say they're going to do. Eventually, you start to believe that's love. You've been trained. So when one of my girls meets a young man who really is going to respect her, she automatically thinks something's wrong with him. And as you say, she does things to provoke him, in effect, sabotages the relationship to get him to treat her the way she's accustomed to being treated, get him to leave. Like Maya Angelou always said, you teach people how to treat you. So I really want to know, is it even possible to fix this if it's how your brain has developed? And if so, how?
Well, the good news is that the brain is malleable all through life. We can change, but we don't randomly change. To use your favorite word, we can intentionally change if we know what needs to be addressed. The key is to recognize the patterns.
Okay, yes. You start by connecting the dots, but then how do you help people see that this is the same problem showing up, that it's just wearing a different pair of pants, because that's usually how it works for people. It's the same type of person continually showing up in their life. They might arrive in a different package. It might be a boss or domineering friend. I say to my girls, look, there's a thread that runs through the course of your life. Look at the kinds of friends you choose, the kinds of personal relationships you have, the boyfriends you are attracted to, and look at what all these people have in common, and then ask yourself how these people make you feel and which of those feelings trigger feelings you've had before. And then when you're experiencing these feelings and saying, oh my, I'm so frustrated, notice whether that person is triggering something that's already there.
These patterns do run through a person's life, and often through their parents' and grandparents' lives. And without recognizing them, it is very difficult to change. The children and adults we work with are so used to chaos, they actually feel more comfortable when it's chaotic than when it's calm. So when they get into a classroom or a new foster home where people are predictable and consistent and thoughtful, it makes them feel uncomfortable. Little by little, they get more and more uncomfortable until they provoke a predictable response. I have teachers and foster parents who tell me, he almost acts like he wants to get punished. And to a certain extent, they're right. He is seeking a predictable response from the world. And predictable for him means being punished, excluded, minimized. He's looking for evidence that his worldview is accurate. The world is chaotic. People aren't trustworthy. I don't belong. He's trying to be kicked out of his class. He is seeking to get kicked out of your home. When we start our work, we try to teach the adults what this behavior really means and how they can recognize it so they don't reenact it.
That's exactly what you told me 10 years ago, the very first week my school in South Africa started, and I called you on day 3. Girls who had just arrived were suddenly acting out, and we didn't know why. I understood there might be homesickness, but you thought some of them might be having trauma-related issues, even PTSD. You pointed out that no matter how challenging their living conditions had been, we had taken the girls out of their homes. At home, in some cases, there were 6 people sleeping in a bed, and now they're sleeping alone. The sheets are different, the level of comfort is different, the sense of order is different. Everyone at the school is here to love the children, to show support, 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 more support.
And this order, stability, and nurturing was a challenge to their worldview. Their brains are going, what the hell is this? They're thinking, I want something familiar. So they start acting out. They create chaos where there is order, thinking, I'm going to make something familiar.
I want disorder. I want what is familiar.
Exactly. So what you have to do is give these children time and experience. They need patience and understanding and sufficient new experiences to sculpt and shape new views of the world. It takes time to create neural networks with a whole new set of associations. And that is what OLEG provides for so many of these girls. Years of new opportunity. Years of cognitively learning new things. And most importantly, years of new relationships, structures, expectations, and new social and emotional lessons. Their worldviews are modified, expanded, clarified, solidified. This takes time, patience, and sometimes therapeutic help.
But it has to be the right therapy.
It's interesting. Most people think about therapy as something that involves going in and undoing what's happened. But whatever your past experiences created in your brain, the associations exist and you can't just delete them. You can't get rid of the past. Therapy is more about building new associations, making new, healthier default pathways. It's almost as if therapy is taking your two-lane dirt road and building a four-lane freeway alongside it. The old road stays, but you don't use it as much anymore. Therapy is building a better alternative, a new default. And that takes repetition and time. Honestly, it works best if someone understands how the brain changes. This is why understanding how trauma impacts our health is essential for everyone. Chapter 7, Post-Traumatic Wisdom. Kids are resilient. They'll get over this. I've heard it so many times. Standing with a New York City official in front of the still smoking wreckage of the World Trade Center. Sitting with FBI agents and Texas Rangers after the ATF raid on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco. Wandering through a blood-splattered apartment with first responders after a shooting witnessed by three young children. Talking with district officials after a school shooting. Hell, dozens of school shootings. The refrain is all too common. Good thing children are resilient. They'll be just fine. We often use our belief in another person's resilience as an emotional shield. We protect ourselves from the discomfort, confusion, and helplessness we feel in the face of their trauma. It's a kind of looking away. It lets our worldview go unchallenged and lets our life continue with minimal disruption. We see this process play out when an individual is impacted by trauma or grief. Often their family, friends, and coworkers begin to orbit a little further out, afraid of the powerful gravitational pull of traumatic pain. As the check-ins get fewer, conversations more superficial, interactions get briefer, and other people move on with their lives, the grieving or traumatized person feels increasingly isolated and alone. The emotional bottom does not come out in the first weeks following the traumatic event. In those early weeks, family, friends, and community generally mobilize to provide emotional support. Your own physical and mental reserves also help, often through the power of dissociation. But while each person's experience is different, after about 6 months, you start hitting bottom, and then you drift along the bottom, rising and falling with anniversary reactions, evocative cues, and opportunities to heal. Some people will keep rising. Others will drown. None will ever be the same. We see the same rationalization and avoidance in the face of large-scale or community trauma. War, famine, natural disasters, school shootings, the transgenerational impact of slavery. The privileged groups turn their gaze from the pain. In the face of systemic racism, we say, look how far they've come. In the face of cultural genocide, they need to assimilate. In the face of trauma, isn't it great that they are resilient? It's so easy to create an other. Us and them is deeply ingrained in our neurobiology, and it's what makes connectedness a double-edged sword. We are strongly connected to our clan, but not so much to other clans. We compete with them for limited resources. When trauma impacts a group of people or a community, there's an epicenter to the event, the people most impacted by the loss and pain. And there's an immediate mobilization of attention, energy, and resources focused on this epicenter. People rush in to help. But this help is often mistimed, disorganized, and almost always ignorant of trauma. Thousands volunteer their time in the first few weeks. 6 months later, no one does. After the initial urge to help, the intensity of traumatic loss starts to exhaust and then drive people away. Schools or towns don't want to be identified as being traumatized. They want to be viewed as thriving. People grow tired of hearing about trauma. They want to talk about healing and hope. This is where the well-intentioned efforts to do something come in. T-shirts with slogans about strength, teddy bears for still dazed children. Parents mourning the death of a child are honored at a football game. These awkward, kind gestures are part of our struggle to help and to erase our sense of helplessness. In the wake of trauma, the hardest thing to understand is that nothing and no one can take away the pain. And yet that's exactly what we desperately want to do, because we are social creatures, subject to emotional contagion. And when we're around people who are hurting, we hurt too. We don't want to hurt. It is hard to sit in the midst of ruined lives and not feel the misery. It helps us regulate to try to undo or negate, to look away from, others' pain. So we make our arbitrary assumptions about people's innate resilience. We make our sweeping declarations that allow us to marginalize traumatized children. We take our focus off the tragedy, move on with our lives, telling ourselves that they will be okay. But as we continue to see in our discussions, the impact of trauma doesn't simply fade away. We can help each other heal, but often assumptions about resilience and grit blind us to the healing that leads us down the painful path to wisdom. Dr. Perry.
One of the most thought-provoking things you've ever said is that children are not born resilient. They are born malleable. Will you explain the difference?
Well, if you take a Nerf ball and squeeze it, bend it, apply all kinds of force to it, it will, in the end, return to its original ball-like shape. That Nerf ball is resilient. This is the kind of resilience people are talking about when they talk about children being resilient in the wake of trauma. They're indulging in the wishful thinking that a child could experience a traumatic stress and somehow magically be unaffected, as though the child would be able to return to their prior level of emotional, physical, social, and cognitive health unchanged. But as we've spent this whole audiobook discussing, that is simply not the way it works. We are always changing. We change from all of our experiences, good and bad. This is because our brain is changeable, malleable. It's always changing. Think about a metal hanger. Let's say you need to fish something out of a drain, and the hanger is your best tool. You apply force to bend it into the shape you want. The hanger is malleable. When the job is done, you can try to bend it back to its original shape, but even if you're a champion hanger bender, you won't get it to exactly what it was. There will be weaknesses in the places where you bent it. And if you were to keep bending and restoring it in the same places, the hanger would ultimately break. Now, we talked earlier about resilience, and it is true that both children and adults can demonstrate resilience, as we say in our field, in the face of a challenge or even trauma. You can demonstrate resilience, and, as we've said, you can build resilience. But it's not resilience in the Nerf ball sense. It's not an automatic property of childhood. The capacity to get back to baseline after a trauma is influenced by many factors, primarily your connectedness.
So, you're saying that no matter what age you are, no one emerges from a trauma unscathed, and that it's impossible to go back to being the same once a trauma has occurred?
To a degree, yes. That is what I'm saying. Again, though, to clarify, the concept of resilience is used in our field. But if you look carefully at our biology after a traumatic experience, all the way down to the way genes are expressed, trauma will change everyone in some way. And these changes will be there even if they don't result in any apparent real-life problems for the person, even if the person demonstrates resilience. A child may continue to do just as well in school, for example, but it may take much more energy and effort. Or we may find that a child is able to return to his previous level of emotional functioning, but changes in his neuroendocrine system may make him more likely to develop diabetes. This is, in essence, what the ACE studies have demonstrated. Adversity impacts the developing child, period. What that impact will be, when it may manifest, and how it may be buffered, we can't always say. But developmental trauma will always influence our body and brain.
If you look at the brain of a traumatized child, will it look different?
Well, our current brain imaging techniques are pretty sophisticated, but they're not yet sensitive enough to scan an individual child and say with confidence, for example, this underactivity in the prefrontal cortex is from abuse. What we do know is that if you compare a group of children who've experienced no abuse with a group of children who've experienced similar timing and type of abuse, there will be statistically significant differences in the size of some areas of the brain, some differences in connections, some differences in activity. But the complexities of development, the brain, and the nature of trauma make neuroimaging studies very difficult to interpret.
So, if you were to look at the brain of a 3-year-old who was nurtured and supported, and the brain of a 3-year-old who was neglected and abused, could you see a difference?
Again, this is very complex, but if the neglect were in the total global neglect category, yes. Using the right imaging techniques, you can see differences. But again, these are really difficult to interpret. The actual best indicators of change in the brain following trauma or neglect are functional changes. Is the child impulsive or inattentive? Do they have speech and language problems or fine motor control issues? Are they depressed or anxious? Do they have a hard time learning? Can they form and maintain healthy relationships? All of these things are much better indicators of changes in the brain than brain scans are. Now, brain scans have shown us that each of us has a unique brain, which, considering everything we've been talking about, is not surprising. And because each of us has a unique brain, we will experience stress, distress, and trauma in a somewhat unique way. Two people who experience the same traumatic event can respond differently and recover differently. When a person is able to recover emotionally, returning to a pre-trauma level of functioning, we refer to that as demonstrating resilience. And the capacity to do that is malleable. In other words, the ability to cope with stress, distress, and trauma is changeable. It's something that we can help build in people. You can make your coping machinery stronger and more effective.
When I was a child, we used the term weathering. We didn't have a word for the kind of trauma so many African Americans endured, so we said we weathered. Church was a big part of how we got through. We weathered together.
You are identifying such a central aspect of building resilience. Your connectedness to other people is so key to buffering any current stressor and to healing from past trauma. Being with people who are present, supportive, and nurturing. Belonging. Of course, other factors also impact a person's capacity to demonstrate resilience. Some of the most important are related to the sensitivity of your stress response systems. Anything that makes those systems more reactive or sensitive will make you more vulnerable. This could include genetic factors, intrauterine exposure to alcohol, a history of attachment problems, or previous trauma. Let's go back to the start of our conversation, back to the core regulatory networks. The core regulatory networks comprise a set of very important neural networks that collectively reach every part of your body and brain. We know that when these systems are well organized, flexible, and strong, we have the capacity to cope with all manner of stressors. We also know that controllable, predictable, and moderate challenges can make the core regulatory networks even stronger. Our stress response capabilities expand when they get practice. So if a child has had the opportunity to have predictable, moderate challenges as they grow up, they will be more capable of demonstrating resilience in the face of a challenge. At the very start of this process is when the newborn is hungry, thirsty, or cold, and the attentive, attuned caregiver meets their needs. Later, they'll crawl away from the safety of their parent and start exploring the world. Because this is novel, it will activate their stress response, but only moderately. When it becomes too much, they'll crawl back to the safe base. This process, leaving the safe, exploring the new, returning to the safe, will continue thousands of times for the toddler and young child. And through these little challenges, they build the capacity to demonstrate resilience in the face of unexpected stress. All development involves being exposed to novelty, which in turn activates our stress response. With a safe and stable relational foundation, thousands of moderate doses of stress help create flexible stress response capabilities. Every school year, meeting new classmates and a new teacher and studying new content provides moderate, predictable stressors. Participating in sports, music, drama, and other activities creates more opportunities for the controllable, predictable stress that helps build resilience. And through all of this, relationships are absolutely key. For the infant, the relationship with primary caregivers is the foundation of their capacity for all future relationships. It is in the context of nurturing and caring relationships that the child can meet a challenge. In the face of any new challenge, an adult can model, encourage, and provide a helping hand. And the relational reward, the smile, word of encouragement, congratulations for progress during and after the challenge, motivates the child, which leads to repetition and mastery. A child without these relational supports will not have as many developmental successes. It's really important to note that the support of parent, teacher, or coach also helps provide the proper dosing of challenge for the child. Challenges should fit the child's developmental stage, because impossible challenges set up children to fail. A child who has not yet learned to multiply cannot be expected to learn algebra. A child who has just learned to write words cannot be expected to write full paragraphs. It's a Goldilocks situation. Just as the challenge shouldn't be too big, it also shouldn't be too small. It has to be novel enough to cause the child to leave the comfort zone of their known experiences and already mastered skills. If the challenge is going to build resilience, it has to be moderate, just right. Finding the just right is a major issue with children who have had trauma. Remember, they frequently live in a persistent state of fear, and fear shuts down parts of the cortex, the thinking part of the brain. In a classroom, what may seem to be a moderate, developmentally appropriate challenge for many children may be an overwhelming demand on a child with a sensitized